It's impressive that you recognize that the notion of women entrepreneurship is not only a business subject, but it's also a halakhic subject, because whenever you go into business, whether you're a man or a woman, obviously there are rules of halakha that govern our dealings and that govern all of the rules and regulations of how to go about doing this. It's presumably something which is self-understood that many men make a living by being a businessman. Perhaps it's considered more of a modern-day notion that in many Jewish homes, the women also go to work, and sometimes they are the primary breadwinners, particularly if the husbands are sitting and learning in kollel or doing other jobs in Avodas HaKodesh. It's often necessary to supplement, and sometimes there isn't necessarily a husband at home altogether. People have different family situations. So it's certainly a proper way of reaching a degree of self-fulfillment and also contributing meaningfully to the community to be involved in business enterprise. In fact, we talk about the Eish Hischayil that we sing about on Friday night. We speak about not simply a woman who's sitting and doing mitzvahs and acts of chesed, but she's supporting a family. She's involved in business enterprise, sometimes traveling far distances. She's working long hours with her business. She's dealing with various merchants. We understand Eish Hischayil is also a mashal. It's meant as a parable and is referring to lots of things, including Torah, including the Shechina. But it's also referring to a notion that the poskim speak about, and this is found in Shulchan Aruch as well. The idea of an Eish Hischayil being a woman who's supporting her family by being a genuine, honest businesswoman. Some of you are familiar with the memoirs that were written by Glockel of Hamelin, who was a German personality, 17th century, who wrote a diary, an autobiography of all of her business dealings, of how she was constantly involved in business activity in order to marry off her children, in order to support her family, support her husband. She was really quite a force of nature, this Glockel, but also very, very inspirational. So the same way that the Gemara in Shabbos speaks about how after 120 years, a person goes up to heaven, the first question that they're asked about is, Nasasa Minasata Bemuna, that you conduct your business dealings in an honest fashion. So this is true of men and women alike. We all have our business dealings in life. Even if we're not small business owners, we all have monetary dealings. We have to conduct ourselves honestly. How much more so? This is true if you really start a whole enterprise, that you have to know what the rules are and you have to go about it l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. A simple test of the sake of heaven is, are you involved in a business that's contributing the yeshuvah shel olam? Are you contributing for the positive welfare of society? Is it something where you're going to be helping people, where you're going to be making their lives better, you're going to be making their lives easier, you're producing a product which is beneficial, which is therapeutic, which is healthy? These are important questions. I mean, I see that with my own wife, my own Rebbetzin. She's a school teacher, but she also does businesses on the side, not terribly successfully. That's why she's mostly a school teacher. But she went into things that she believes in very strongly. She started selling the Shackley products, where you have a kosher medicine supplements and soap products and beauty products and health products, that everything is good for you. And she wanted to do it because she believed in it. And now she got involved with Arban, same sort of concepts. I don't know fully the difference between one or the other, but it's the same basic concept of selling healthful goods, so that not only will she make a little bit of money, but that she'll be helping people to live a healthier lives. So that's something that I think is important to think about when you go into any type of business, that it should be edifying. It should be something that you're not going into the business to sell recreational marijuana or e-cigarettes. You go into a business where it's going to be helpful. It's going to help. It's going to be good for people. A lot of businesses have sprouted up in the last couple of years that are home-based food businesses where people are preparing food at home. That could be a nice thing too, that you're producing foods that help people enjoy their Shabbos meals, their Yontif meals, and so forth. But here as well, it's important to recognize that there are serious halakhic issues. One very important halakhic issue is something that was described in a Kol Kore, a public letter that went out this past week. It was published in all the newspapers by major rabbinic personalities in North America, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, Rav Shlomo Miller from Toronto, Rav Yaakov Orsheimer, the senior posek in Lakewood, and of course our own Rav Shmuel First Shlita, that says that we have a long-standing tradition in Jewish law, quoting various Jewish law authorities, including the Beit Hillel from the 17th century, that whenever food is prepared for sale, as opposed to when you're preparing food to simply give to a neighbor who had just had a baby and you want to prepare a meal, no problem. But if you're preparing food for sale, regardless of the credentials of the producer of the food, there's a requirement for kosher supervision, hashgacha, from an outside source. It's important. You're doing something good. You have a home business. You're selling food, but you have to get an outside hashgacha. Even if a person is trustworthy, a more rigorous standard of supervision is required when the person has a business that sells products for profit. Therefore, we're starting this letter as a reminder and a reinforcement for all those who either produce such food products or might purchase such food products. The food produced for a profit should not be purchased unless it either bears a reputable hashgacha or a respected rav gives his personal hashgacha on the operation. Ends with a bracha that all owners of home businesses should obtain certification as a fulfillment. Of their halakhic obligations, and the merit of doing so, we bless them that Hashem should provide them with sustenance and great success. So I mentioned this as a public service. That I don't know if any of you are in the food business industry, and you see that so many people don't necessarily get the hashgacha. It's true, the major hashgachas are not always available for home businesses for various legal reasons we won't go into. But nonetheless, it's important to go and get the proper kosher certification. I read it, number one, as a public service. Number two, because I believe in the importance of this halakha and the correctness of the message. Number three, because I actually wrote this. Now, another issue that arises is the question of nowadays, we're in the Shemitah year, as Wendy mentioned. So there are only about a week left until the Shemitah year. You have business operations, you have accounts receivable. Accounts receivable, people owe you money. So if anybody owes you money that's passed through, it doesn't matter whether the debt was originally extended as a loan or whether it was a service that you provided and the person is just late on their payment. From a halakhic, from a Jewish law perspective, it's considered to be a loan. And therefore, it's included in the pasuk in Parshas Re'eh that we read a couple of weeks ago. It says, you're not allowed to pursue somebody who owes you money for a loan that was not paid prior to the end of the Shemitah year, because it's automatically shemot. It's automatically canceled at the end of the Shemitah year. So if you have accounts receivable that you're not going to collect over the course of the next week, you're not going to be allowed to insist on payment from the person who owes the money. So this is sort of an urgent matter. I thought I would have, mention it to you. But there's one way that you can get around the problem. I spent 3 hours today sitting down for a prusbul signing sessions. What's a prusbul? A prusbul is a document that you can sign. And it's something which has to be signed by anybody to whom money is owed, whether it's a man or whether it's a woman, it's not a time-bound positive commandment from which women are exempt. It includes women as well, that if you want to make sure that the amounts that are owed to you and your businesses are not going to be canceled by the end of the Shemitah year, you have to hand over those loans to a rabbinical court, to a betin. That's what a prusbul does. Now, a prusbul, you sign a document saying, I'm hereby handing over these all of the loans that I'm owed, all of the debts that I'm owed, to the rabbinical court. Therefore, it's considered as if it's already collected, like it's in the hands of the rabbinical court, and it's not canceled at the end of the Shemitah year. So there are many, many people who came to us today to execute prusbul documents. Many husbands who came, I said, are you executing it on behalf of your wife? They said, oh, why should I? Said, could be your wife has a side business, right? I know I'm giving a lecture tonight. There are, you know, plenty of women who have businesses. So a number of them did execute the prusbul on behalf of their wives. But if you haven't had a prusbul executed by yourself or on your behalf, you have 1 week to take care of this. You go on the Chicago Rabbinical Council website, and you can get a hold of prusbul forms. If you can't appear before a rabbinical court, you can appear before two witnesses and simply sign the form in front of two witnesses that you're handing over any debts in front of a rabbinical court. They don't have to be present. You just make that attestation in front of two witnesses, and then it's considered like the debts have been handed over to the rabbinical court, and all of the obligations that are owed to you will not be canceled. But I urge you, it's very important to take care of this. I sometimes have cases that come in front of the Beit Din where somebody's looking to collect a debt after the Shemitah year, and the person who owes the debt says, well, did you execute a prusbul? And the person sometimes says, no, I forgot, I didn't execute a prusbul. Well, then I'm not paying you, because the debt was canceled. But not such a simple matter. Really, according to the halakha, the person who owes the debt is told that it's the proper thing to pay it anyway. There's supposed to be a procedure where the person says, I'm here to pay my debt. And then you say to the person, no, it's okay, I cancel it, because the Shemitah year canceled it. And then, if the person knows the script, the next thing they're supposed to say is, no, Apopikin, nonetheless, I want to give it to you as a gift. And then everything is all fine and dandy. But sometimes people forget the script, and they don't come to repay the loan, or they don't say, Apopikin, nonetheless, I'm going to repay the amount. And then you don't have the ability to exact it from them in Beit Din. So therefore, it's very important over the course of the next week, for the sake of your businesses and the viability of your businesses, that you take care of a prusbul. Another modern-day question that I get all the time, and it really shouldn't affect small businesses so much. It mostly affects very large businesses, but sometimes these operations tend to grow very quickly, is the notion of the 24/7 availability of the business in the consumer market. That if you have a business that shuts down completely for Shabbos, shuts down for Yontif, if it's a service business, so sometimes the customers say, well, if I'm not going to be able to get service over Shabbos, sometimes there's software and they need assistance, they want to be able to call in, whatever it is, then I'm going to go elsewhere. And therefore, there's much more of a desire, shall we say, among frum business owners nowadays to have businesses that remain open during Shabbos, at least that there's somebody available for service calls and things of that variety. Very, very complicated area of halacha, because even if your business is open on Shabbos, and you're resting on Shabbos, and you're going to shul, and you're saying Tehillim, and you're having your Shabbos meals, and you're not doing any work on Shabbos, but if the business that you own is doing business through your employees, even if they're non-Jewish employees, that's a violation. You're not allowed to do that. That's considered to be masu matan. That's considered to be a violation of doing business on Shabbos. Any money that would be earned through that enterprise, even if you yourself are not doing any work on Shabbos, would be prohibited. You wouldn't be allowed to enjoy that money from the fruits of the business on that day, because that's called Schar Shabbos. It's a prohibition against earning any money that was generated based on business operations owned by you on Shabbos. So really the simple answer is, in all of these cases, shut down your business on Shabbos, that you can make enough money without working on Shabbos. But the poskim point out that if you have a type of business that would simply not be able to remain viable, you have a store in a mall, And the requirement of the mall owner is that all the stores be open on Shabbos, and otherwise you're not going to be able to operate the store. We had somebody open up a hot dog stand in Wrigley Field, and then the owners of Wrigley Field said, you want to have a hot dog, kosher hot dog stand in Wrigley Field, we can't give you a concession unless it's open for all of the games. So we had to work out with them that the stand would be open, but it wouldn't belong to them. They would sell it to a non-Jew for Shabbos, and the non-Jew would make all of the profit over Shabbos. They wouldn't make up one penny of profit. It would all go to the non-Jew for Shabbos. And on that basis, we were willing to give a certification. So you have to work out. You have to contact your local, your friendly Beit Din, and see what can be done. Sometimes you can go into business with a non-Jew, and then it's the non-Jewish partner, the Gemara talks about this, that's doing the work on Shabbos, who's choosing to keep the business open on Shabbos, and they can keep the profit, so they can choose to divide it with you. Or you can divvy it up that you're together most of the week, but one day during the week the business only belongs to you, and then on Shabbos the business only belongs to the non-Jew, so you decide to split everything 50-50. There are different ways of doing it. It's complicated, but you should be aware of this issue, and sometimes people don't pay attention. I remember I once got a call from the producers of a Broadway show. Putting on a Broadway show, they were Jewish producers, and I guess they had some observance that they wanted to do things in a kosher way, but they felt they're not going to make a profit from the Broadway show unless it's open on Shabbos. So they wanted to sell the business, to sell the show to other producers who would have an ownership stake in this production just for days of Shabbos, for the Friday night shows, for the Shabbos afternoon matinees, whatever it was. This was a big Broadway show about the life and times of a great Jewish rabbi who was also a singer and a composer. I'll leave, you know, the identity to your imagination. They wanted to make a big Broadway show celebrating his identity, but they didn't want to close down on Shabbos. So somehow they got my name, and they called me and asked whether I can help them have this Schar Shabbos, this magical potion, so to speak, where the business would be, the Broadway show would be transferred to non-Jewish ownership on those days. So I said, I have a problem with this, that even if you would do it, and even if the sale would satisfy all of the bells and the whistles and all of the specifications of Jewish law, who's going to come to see the show? Most of the people are going to come to see the show are Jewish. So you can't have even a business that you're going to facilitate to be open on Shabbos, even if it's completely owned by a non-Jew, if it's going to be Lifnei Iver, if it's going to be a stumbling block in front of the blind, meaning it's going to cause people to sin, it's going to cause your fellow Jews to do aveiros. So therefore, I can't support you in this particular effort. But I told them, I'm good at giving out brachos, I told them that if you keep the show closed on Shabbos so that you're not going to cause any Jews to travel on the Shabbos day, and you'll just have the show all the other days of the week, so I give you a tremendous blessing that the show should be a resounding success. They didn't listen to me. So the show didn't last too long. Yeah. But the Mishnah Berurah says that Kol Avoteach B'Hashem Ashrav, that when it comes to all of these matters, the more that you trust in Hashem, the more fortunate you're going to be. And so really, I mention it to you in case there really is a tremendous need like the Wrigley Field situation that I described. But as a general matter, the business should be closed down on Shabbos. And even if you have a website, the website should be closed down on Shabbos as well. Now, that's a little trickier, meaning that if you have something like a Judaic operation where you know that the people who would access the website are Jewish, so you should close it down because otherwise you're inviting them to be involved in going on the internet on Shabbos doing aveiros, and you shouldn't facilitate that in any way. So you should just say close for Shabbos like they do at B&H Photo. In New York, they close down their website for all of Shabbos. Now, if you are primarily serving a non-Jewish clientele, then there are heterim, there are leniencies based on the old tshuvos, the responsa to speak about people used to have vending machines. They would have vending machines where they would sell candy or they would sell cigarettes, whatever it is that they would sell. This is going back 100, 150 years ago. This was back in Europe. They had tshuvos about this. And the question was, did they have to close down the vending machines on Shabbos? So many of the poskim said it's not necessary for a person to disable their vending machine on Shabbos. Why is that? Because they're not specifically directing people to buy the products on Shabbos. They'd be just as happy if the customers would go to the vending machine on Friday afternoon or on Motzei Shabbos. So since they're not specifically encouraging them to come on Shabbos, so therefore they felt that it would be permissible on that basis. But others weren't so sanguine about this, because they said that still, if the money is being put in on Shabbos, so your business is acquiring the money on Shabbos. So they suggested that a person make some arrangement where the money would not be registered in the name of the company until after Shabbos. So if it's a website, if you disable the ability for a credit card to go through, let's say Shabbos, it probably would wait until afterwards. I don't know how it works on weekends nowadays, but certainly on holiday days during the week, that you have some sort of a mechanism where the sale is not going to be finalized if somebody would go on the site during Shabbos until after Shabbos is over. And so then that's the best way to go and to arrange this to be done. Now, another issue that comes up in small businesses is you have a small staff. You have a small group of people who are working for you. You have men and women who are working in the same office. So you sometimes have yichud issues. What's yichud? Yichud, as we know, is the prohibition, according to most commentators. It's a Torah prohibition. It's a Torah prohibition that you're also lisyachin, me'er me'arayos. You're not allowed to be secluded with a person who's prohibited to be with you, who's not your husband, for example, or your parents or your children. Because if you have seclusion with a person leads, unfortunately, to other averus. One thing leads to another. But even if it doesn't lead to anything, just the seclusion itself is considered to be an avera. That itself is a sin that requires kapara on Yom Kippur. So what do? You have a small office and you have a male worker. So during the day, if you have people who are coming in and out of the office, so that's what we call Pesach Pasuach L'Rishus HaRabim. That's a special leniency that if you have a door that's open to a public thoroughfare and lots of people can come in at any time, so then you don't really have seclusion, and that would be okay. If people are constantly coming in and out and lots of people have access to the office, they have the keys to the office, or the door is open, and there are lots of people immediately outside, that's okay. But you're going to come in, and you're going to do work late at night, you're going to stay in the office late at night, or you're going to be in the office on the weekend, and suddenly you discover that you're there, and it's just yourself and another male worker. So then already you have a problem of yichud. Yichud applies if you're together with a male, or if one male is together with two females. So you have a yichud problem. If it's two males and a female, and the two males are kosher, erlich individuals, you're okay. If they're not, so then you're not okay. So you have to really take proper precautions to see to it that when this situation, if you are going to stay late, that you either leave the doors wide open and stay near the open door, or you potentially, there's a heter, if you have your own individualized office and you lock yourself inside your office so that the man who's in the office doesn't have the ability to get into your office, so some are lenient, so that's a possible solution, not an ideal solution, better not to be in the situation altogether, but that's a possible solution. But this is something that people are very lax about nowadays, that you really have to be careful about. In general, given the society in which we live, it's also very important not to get too cozy with certain individuals. If you get cozy with a male worker, that could just mean that you're friendly, you share coffee together, you talk about your family lives and your simchas together. That's already a coziness. It doesn't have to be that it leads to anything worse than that. God forbid, it shouldn't. But nonetheless, you have a social relationship. That's called libo gaspo. That's already a coziness. So once you have that stage of coziness, certain leniencies don't apply. Like there's a leniency called baila b'ir. Baila b'ir means that if a woman's in an office with a man, but her husband is in the city, and her husband could presumably drop by and say hello at any time, so then it's okay for her to be together with a man. But that heter, that leniency of a baila b'ir, does not apply when there's a coziness in the relationship between the man and the woman. So once you have even a secretary-boss relationship, which often is cozy, if any kind of cozy relationship, it's not necessarily a prohibition to have a cozy relationship with proper boundaries, but you have to recognize that if it exists, so then you can't rely on these types of leniencies, and then you have to be even more careful. So some of businesses, you're providing services, you go to people's homes, you're providing therapy, whatever, there's a whole range of different types of services that are provided. You have to be very careful when it comes to this issue of seclusion. You need to have other people around on a regular basis. On that note, I'll say two things. That in the business world, you don't have the same degree of sneers, the same degree of built-in modesty when you're simply at home and you have the benefit of the principle of kol kavuda bas melech penima, that the glory of a Jewish princess is to be inside of her own home. We're familiar with that. The principle. Principle stands for the idea that there's more of a protective shield. There's a more of an inner sanctum, a fortress in a person's home. The more that you develop in the business world relationships with other people, you have to understand the world that we live in today is a world without proper boundaries, and where people violate and expect to violate those boundaries all the time, particularly when you're dealing with people outside of the firm community. But sometimes, even when you are dealing with people inside of the firm community, people are only human. And you have to realize that humans are frail. You have to be careful. If you're going to have meetings with a man, there should be somebody else in the meeting. There should be at least two men. There should be three women and a man. You should have multiple people. If you're going to have a correspondence, email correspondences, there should be a shomer. We talk about in a yichud situation, you have another person around, even a young child who's a shomer, who's a watch person, preventing the yichud. Even in email correspondences, should be a watch person. There's somebody else just to make sure that the conversation doesn't take a turn for greater social comfort, for maybe a little bit of too much bantering, of too much friendliness. So you have somebody else copied. And texts should be avoided at all costs, because people get into a texting relationship, it can be very, very bad. So these are just a few of the cautionary notes that I'm mentioning to you. This also relates to when you have business trips. You have business trips, better to avoid business trips, because in business trips, people sometimes go out for a drink, things of that sort, things that are very antithetical to halacha. You're going to go on a business trip, you have a husband, better to take your husband with you if you have to go on a business trip. It's mentioned by Wendy Margolin about the idea, the obligation of paying workers on time. I think that's one of the things that I mentioned to Mrs. Katz. So this is a very important halacha. People think that, okay, not such a big deal. Who expects to get paid exactly on time? I don't have the money right now. I'll pay it a day or two later. You violated a major prohibition in the Torah. Major prohibition in the Torah. Lo savo alav ha-shemesh, lo salin pulas sachir itcha boker. Somebody who's a day laborer who finishes working at night, you only have the 12-hour period at night to pay them. Somebody's a night laborer, they finish their work at the crack of dawn, you only have the 12 days of daylight to pay them, and otherwise you have violated two Torah prohibitions, potentially, and you've also violated the positive commandment of b'yomo sitein sacharo, that you have a positive commandment to pay somebody on time. This does not only apply to salaried employees when it comes time to their paycheck. If you've stipulated they get paid at a certain day, If you don't have the money, you don't have the money. That's okay. So you know what the Chafetz Chaim says? You don't have the money? You know what you should be doing all day? You should be knocking on doors and begging people to loan you money so you'll be able to pay your workers on time. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You have to take this obligation very, very seriously. You have merchandise to sell. You better sell that merchandise in order to pay the workers on time. If with all of that you still don't have money, okay, then you haven't violated the transgression, but you also haven't fulfilled the positive commandment of paying the worker on time. Something you have to take very seriously. But it even applies to independent contractors. Independent contractor who's working in your office, the painter, you hire a painter to paint the office. They finish work with the paint job at 5 p.m. And Shkia, sunset is at 6:45 p.m. You know how much time you have to pay them? An hour and 45 minutes. If they finish in the middle of the day, you don't have 12 hours. You only have till the end of the day. They finish in the middle of the night, you don't have 12 hours. You got to pay them in the middle of the night. My wife and I made a chasana, Baruch Hashem, about a month ago, and we had a couple of last-minute additions that we decided to take on just to enhance the simcha. The singer would sing during the chuppah. It's another $300 of the band. We added a saxophonist, another $700. The singer comes to me after the wedding. It's probably 12 midnight. And he says, oh, I really enjoyed, you know, being able to sing at your chasana. I said, yeah, it was great. It was wonderful. It was fantastic. Thank you so much. And so he leaves. I think that's nice. He introduced himself to me. I was really pleased with his singing. And then, obviously, I didn't get the hint. So he came back to me and he said, well, you know, I had gotten paid for, you know, the rest of the singing, but the chuppah you added, that's $300, you know. So I realized, oh, he has to get paid right now. It's 12 midnight. I pulled out. I had some cash. Baruch Hashem, somebody told me to bring a lot of cash. So I brought. So I had. I handed him $300. Then the saxophonist, you know, came and he said, you know, I was there last minute. And that's $700. I didn't have $700 in cash, but I told my wife about it, and she has this thing called Zelle, and she Zelled over the money before the crack of dawn, so he got paid during the night, so we didn't transgress this mitzvah. But if you are any type of a business enterprise, so you have to recognize that this is a very, very serious obligation. Now, there is a way, the Gemara tells us, to avoid transgressing the prohibition in case, like, you make a mistake, you get preoccupied, you forget. So if you hire somebody through an agent, you don't hire them directly, you hire them through an agent, and so then the person doesn't necessarily expect they're going to get paid on the day that the service is rendered because they didn't have that comfort level of being hired by the employer himself or herself in your case. So then you have a little bit more latitude. But even then, you should make an effort to pay the person on time in order to fulfill the positive commandment of Yomo Sitein Sakaro. It's just this way, in case you make a mistake, you would not have violated the negative commandment if you hire the person through an agent. Just one way out of this potential prohibition, you have your secretary or somebody else hire the person, and it's understood that the ultimate responsibility is upon you. There's somebody left a question to me regarding a situation where they're hired and then somehow in the middle of the employment period, the employer decides to let them off, to terminate their employment. So what's your obligation once you've taken somebody on? It doesn't have to be a signed written contract. If there's even a verbal contract where there's an understanding that there's a term of employment and you decide that you're going to terminate that person before the end of the term, then you may have obligations to pay the person anyway until the time that the contract was supposed to expire. Now, there are exceptions to the rule. If there are circumstances that are beyond your control, this came up, like, for example, when COVID hit, and businesses had to suddenly close down. It could be that you're off the hook. COVID might be an exception when you're not off the hook, but it's a general rule. If there is an unforeseen circumstance, unless it's an unforeseen circumstance that you as a business owner had more reason to know about than the person that you hired, then there's no reason for them to suffer from it, then you have to pay them other way anyway. But otherwise, you're generally protected with unforeseen circumstance. But it's not an unforeseen circumstance. You just decide that you want to go in a different direction, but it's not that some traumatic event occurred. that's requiring you to let go of the worker, and the worker was relying upon this money and gave up other business opportunities, other employment opportunities, so you may be on the hook. You might only be on the hook to pay a portion of their salary, what's called poel batel, the amount that a person gets a certain benefit from not working, that they get to just kind of sit around and not do anything all day, so it's not as hard as actually working, so maybe they don't have to get paid 100% of the salary, maybe they only have to get paid 50%, but they do have to get paid something. So you have to really stipulate very carefully with any person that you hire, whether it's as a full-time employee, a part-time employee, a contractor, you have to stipulate the terms up front very, very carefully so that there not be misunderstandings about, number one, the expectations, number two, the payments and the time of payments, and because if you stipulate, the payment will be on a certain day, so you have until that day. And number three, with respect to what are the grounds for termination, so that otherwise I can't tell you how many Dinei Torah I get in our Beis Din from people who claim that they were victims of unjust termination, that they were fired without good reason. So if you don't set forth that the person's an employee at will, you say you don't really have a contractual term, I can fire you anytime, or I can fire you because I just decide that I want to go in a different direction, and that's completely fine. If you don't spell these things out, so then you might end up with Dinei Torah on your hands. So it's very, very important to really stipulate the terms and conditions as much as possible beforehand. If you know that you're not going to renew a person's contract, for example, the Chazon Ish says that you have an obligation of notification. You can't just wait until the last day of the person's employment term to say, oh, by the way, I'm not renewing your contract. Oh, you should have figured it out because I never said anything to you. No, it's not right. The Chazon Ish says that just like the Gemara talks about how a landlord has to give notice to the tenant if the landlord's not planning to continue the lease, and the tenant has to give notice to the landlord, so too an employer has to give notice to an employee if they're not planning to renew the contract. That's why in a lot of the schools, they give notice around April time or before Pesach, so that if a teacher's not going to be renewed, they have a little bit of time at least to search for another position. But it's not right to wait until the last day to tell somebody that their contract is not going to be renewed. There is a prohibition of arkos. What's the prohibition of arkos? That's a prohibition to litigate in civil court. So what does that mean? It means that if two Jews have a dispute, they have an obligation. If they're going to litigate the dispute, it must be litigated in Beis Din, in a rabbinical court, and not in a civil court. If it's litigated in a civil court, that's considered to be a desecration of God's name. It's considered to be a chilul Hashem. It's like you're saying that the rabbinical courts that were established by the system that was set up by God himself is not good enough to give you justice in this world, and you have to turn to the non-Jewish courts. It's like a tremendous insult, a tremendous affront to the dignity and to the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, you have to be very careful about that as well. If you're going to enter into a contract, for example, an employment arrangement with an employee who's Jewish, so you can't write in the contract, oh, if we have a dispute, we're going to submit the dispute to the courts of Illinois. You're not allowed to do that because that's a violation. You have to say, we're going to submit it to a Beis Din. You don't have to choose the CRC. I'm not here to advertise. But you choose some sort of a Beis Din that everybody is comfortable with. It could be a Zabla process where you say that the one side will pick one Dayan and you'll pick a Dayan. Those two Dayan will pick a third Dayan, whatever it is. But it has to be a Beis Din mechanism, not a secular court mechanism. That's also important to know because very often you just have boilerplate contracts that you take from people who have other businesses, and you don't realize that the rules are different if you're Jewish. If you're following Torah, you're following Halakha, the rules are not exactly the same. You could say in the contract that let's say that you have a comfort level, the way that people do business in your industry, you're in the real estate industry, so they follow the local Illinois real estate law. So you want to say that all disputes will be decided in accordance with Illinois real estate law. You have a brokerage agreement, something like that. So nothing wrong with doing that, Because if you make a tanai, you make a condition, you're going to follow a certain set of principles of monetary law. So the rule is, in halacha, called tanai sheba mamon kayim. All conditions that only have to do with monetary matters are considered to be valid. As long as you're not making a condition to eat the treif or to violate Shabbos or commit some sort of a transgression, that's perfectly fine. But you're not allowed to have the litigation in front of a secular court. So you can say, well, go to Besdin. Besdin will decide the matter in accordance with Illinois law. How is Besdin going to know what Illinois law has to say? Well, you go to a Besdin that has like good lawyers or whatever, that they're able to figure out what Illinois law has to say. So that's permissible. You're allowed to have a choice of law that you're going to follow Illinois law, but the choice of forum in terms of the tribunal that will adjudicate the case, that has to be a Besdin and not a secular court. There sometimes are non-compete agreements. When parties hire somebody, you have a business, you're going to teach somebody the tricks of the trade. Not everybody is always so generous that they want to teach somebody everything about windows and then have that person compete against them. Sometimes you figure, I'm going to teach this person everything about windows. I don't want them to compete against me. That's not why I'm hiring them and investing so much time and money. So can you put into the contract that the person is not allowed to compete against you, and they're not allowed to take their the expertise you're teaching them in order to compete against you? So if it's for a reasonable period of time, since this is also consistent with some of the provisions that are considered to be acceptable in the marketplace, in the contemporary marketplace, what we call minhag sochim, you are allowed to have such provisions as long as it's drafted as a condition for employment, that you write in the employment contract, that in return for the fact that I am training you, so part of what I'm paying you for, part of your salary is that you're getting money for agreeing that you're not going to compete against me for a certain period of time. That's the way the Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, explained that it has to work from a halakhic perspective in a tshuva that he wrote a couple of hundred years ago. So there is a halakhic way of drafting such a clause, and this is why it's very important when you draft these types of agreements to consult with a halakhic expert, your local Choshe Mishpat Kolo, your local Besdin, your local Rav, in order to make sure that you're drafting it in a way that's going to work from a Besdin perspective. If you don't draft it that way, so then the Besdin might say it's an asmachta, that there was no tit for tat, and it's just a penalty provision, and penalty provisions are often not enforceable in halakha. So you have to draft it. You have to draft it the right way. Are you allowed to open up a business if there is another business that is already basically selling the same type of product? So we have a policy at the CRC that whenever there's a restaurant that's opening up and it's selling substantially the same type of food as another restaurant that's in the same vicinity, we send a letter to the other restaurant that already exists, and we say, if you want to register a complaint to stop this other restaurant from opening up or from opening up in the fashion that it desires because you feel that it's encroaching upon your business and you feel that it's an unjust, unfair business competition, what we call hasagas gevul in halacha, so then you have the right to make that assertion in front of our bezin. That's what we just read about this last week's pasha. Arur masi gevul reyeu. Right? That's considered to be a bad thing if you're going to encroach upon another person's territory. And some of the commentators say this is not just referring to the type of encroachment that was alluded, that was mentioned when the Torah says in Parshas Shoftim, Lo sasi gevul reyecha, that you're not allowed to literally trespass on the property of your fellow, that if you have a border between one property and the next, so you're not allowed to go and utilize the property that is beyond the border and that goes into the other person's physical property. That's what it means in Parshas Shoftim. But in Parshas Kisavo, so there are commentators who say this means unfair business competition. That's what the Torah is talking about when it says, Arur masi gevul reyeu. Sometimes it's not right. You're taking away a person's business. You're selling the identical product. You're making it impossible for this person to make a living. So you have to be sensitive to that sort of thing. And sometimes that does require a din Torah. Sometimes that requires an adjudication in front of a Besdin. If the products
are not identical. They're not homogeneous products, but you have a slightly different product, or you're able to sell the product but at a lower cost because you figured out how to take advantage of market conditions in a more creative and in a more efficient way that you're selling at a lower cost. So then many of the poskim say that it's perfectly legitimate to compete under those circumstances. Why is that? Because we have to be concerned not only about the other business owner, but we also have to be concerned about the welfare of the consumers. The consumers are going to get a better product from you, so then it might be permissible, it often will be permissible under those circumstances. I remember when I was at Yeshiva in Washington Heights, so there was one pizza store that was always the staple, that they sold pizza for many, many years. It's very greasy pizza, but it's okay, you know, pizza, so you eat pizza, you're a student, whatever's available. Then another store opened up, a dairy restaurant, they were also selling pizza. So the first pizza owner got very, very upset. They said that this is Hasagas Gavul, you're encroaching upon my business, because now people are going to buy pizza in the other place. So they went to my Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita. So he said, is this a problem, Hasagas Gavul? He said, no, because I like the pizza in the other place better. He said, it's a better pizza. So that's not Hasagas Gavul. Hasagas Gavul is when one person is selling eggs and the other person sells eggs. Well, it's exactly the same type of product. So there is more wiggle room than people realize, but you still have to be careful because sometimes it could be a problem. And now, sometimes in a business setting, you have Lashon Hara considerations. Even Lashon Hara considerations, so we know that you're not supposed to speak badly about other people. That's a big avera of Lashon, Lo Selech Rachil Be'amecha, a big avera of Lashon Hara. But what if you need to give feedback about how a particular person is doing, how a particular person is performing in the business, so that you can have conversations with the other executives in the business, whether to renew a person's employment or not. You have to evaluate their job performance, things of that variety. So you have to be very, very careful. The general rule is that whenever there's a toelis, if there's a constructive purpose that is going to cause a loss to the business, if you're not able to identify certain problems, so that could be a constructive purpose. So then there's a heter, but then you have to satisfy all of the conditions that the Chofetz Chaim enumerates in order to be allowed to speak Lashon Hara. You're not allowed to exaggerate. You have to know the information firsthand. And if it's only through hearsay, you have to say that it's through hearsay. You can't have any personal animus. You can't have any enmity about the person that you're complaining about, that you're out to get them. You can only divulge the least amount that is necessary to divulge, and not more than that. If you can rectify a problem, a person's not performing the job properly, and before complaining to other people about them, you can talk to them and maybe get them to do the job better, so then you're obligated to do that first before you start complaining about them. And you have to ensure that the harm that's going to come to the person, you give a negative performance review or something, that the harm that they're going to suffer is not greater than what is deserved under the circumstances. If really they deserve, you know, a slap on the wrist, and you know, ultimately they'll be able to do better in the future. But you know that based on whoever you're speaking to, maybe your co-boss or whoever it is, that they're going to just fire the person entirely, and they're going to besmirch their name so they'll never be able to get another job again, which is going to be a punishment that far exceeds the crime, so to speak. So then it would not be permissible. So you have to weigh all of these different considerations. There's no such thing as carte blanche that everything becomes permissible just because you're in a business setting. You have to be very, very careful about your speech. Those of you who have been involved with shadchanos know this to be the case, right? Because shadchanim sometimes get a bad name, that you go into shiduchim so you can speak lashon hara about everybody. So we know that's obviously not true, but there has to be a recognition that even though shadchanim do we have to speak about people in terms of figuring out who to set up with whom, they nonetheless have to observe all of these rules that were set forth by the Chofetz Chaim, all the rules and regulations that restrict the way in which you speak about people, and not to go beyond what is necessary. You have to be careful also when it comes to business meetings and the like. You might be dealing with some people in the non-Frum, the non-Jewish world and so forth. You have to be careful, as I mentioned before, about not being secluded with people, but you also have to be careful not to fraternize too much. One thing is, I remember when I worked as a lawyer way back when, so one of the big questions was, you go out to a kosher, non-kosher restaurant, go out to a non-kosher restaurant, they would celebrate a closing of a deal, something of that sort, and it was considered to be insulting if you didn't join the party. So I learned a trick, which was that if you show up for dessert, so then you don't have to worry about ordering specially double-wrapped kosher meals and being embarrassed and, you know, eating it in a place which makes you very uncomfortable. You can just sit around the table. Nobody expects you to eat or drink anything at dessert. Everyone's just schmoozing. So you can order a Coke. Order a Coke and don't put a lemon in it. And you just sip the Coke the entire time and you're perfectly fine. But better you should avoid, obviously, meeting people in those restaurants and never, ever, ever go into a bar. Never go into a bar. That's all. End of story. There are different post-game we'll talk about, or maybe you can have coffee in a bar, you just shouldn't have alcoholic beverages in a bar. No. A Jewish woman shouldn't be in a bar, period. Figure out how to avoid that. It's not a question. Ultimately, you have to figure out how to pursue the goals and the values of making your business succeed, and at the same time, maintaining the highest standards of Kiddush Hashem, being a sanctification of God's name in the way that you're scrupulous about Shabbos, you're scrupulous about kashrus, you're scrupulous about sneas, you're scrupulous about honesty in all of your business dealings, you're scrupulous about chesed, about giving people a break, about not being overly harsh with people as well. And that will be the best formula for success, the best formula for hatzlacha. I'll just finish with one last thought, and then you can ask questions if you have any. And again, I apologize for the hoarseness of my voice today. There's the Rebbetzin businesswoman herself. Okay, good. So the one last thought, apropos for seeing my wife and my daughter, is that the Gemara in Shabbos talks about a person has a choice. They only have enough money to afford either Chanukah licht or Shabbos candles. They don't have enough money for both. The Chanukah licht is Pesume Nisa, that you're spreading awareness of Hashem, the appreciation for the miracle of Chanukah throughout the entire world. That's such a gewaltige thing to do. And the Shabbos candles represent Shalom Bayis, just the peace and tranquility of the Jewish home. So which one comes first? So the Gemara says Shalom Bayis comes first. The peace and tranquility of the Jewish home, that beats Pirsumei Nisa. It's important to recognize that if you have a family, so you're certainly helping the family, promoting the needs of the family by going into a business and building a business in a successful and proper way, but you can't allow that to overwhelm the primacy of Shalom Bayis in the home. There ever is a situation where you end up with a tension between wanting to build a business, spend more time in the business, but it's going to end up upsetting the Shalom Bayis. So you always have to remember that the Shalom Bayis comes first, and the husbands have to remember that too. So I give you a bracha of Yiratzon Shetishre Shechina B'Maisei Yedeichem, that with all of your work and your business enterprises, that the Divine Presence should rest upon your handiwork. All right.
Okay, so if I place a buy order online and it executes on Rosh Hashanah or Shabbos, is that permitted?
If you specifically programmed it to execute on Rosh Hashanah, it's a problem. If you just programmed it to execute whenever the price should be a certain amount, and it happened to end up on Rosh Hashanah, so any post can say that's not a problem if it didn't have to be on Rosh Hashanah.
Okay. And what if your business dealing is with non-Jews, if you have debts owed to you, like many of the things you talked about, do they apply if your clients are non-Jews?
Yes, when I speak about paying workers on time, so the Gemara says that if you're dealing with a ger toshav, you're dealing with a non-Jew who has accepted upon himself or herself the seven Noahide laws in front of a rabbinical court, So then the mitzvah, the positive commandment of paying on time, is applicable to that worker. So some say, oh, that's a ger toshav. That's in the days when we had a proper bezdin, the days of the Beis HaMikdash, you had the Sanhedrin, people would go and they would accept upon themselves to be a ger toshav. Now, okay, you have civilized, law-abiding non-Jews, but they're not officially a ger toshav. But the Rambam says otherwise. The Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvah says that this applies to all non-Jews. To all non-Jews, there's a mitzvah to pay them on time. It doesn't matter, Jewish, non-Jewish, there's a mitzvah, you have to pay them on time. In terms of honesty and business dealings, the Gemara says that when it comes to being forthright and avoiding what we call Geneva's Das, that you shouldn't sell a piece of merchandise and pretend that it's greater than it really is. So that prohibition applies to Jews and to non-Jews equally. So you should assume, by and large, most of the prohibitions, most of the requirements that I'm talking to you about, really apply to equally to Jews and to non-Jews.
Including the debts that are
prosable. No, not prosable. Okay, not prosable. Right. Not everything. Okay. If there's a non-Jew who owes you money, so it's not canceled by the end of the Shemitah year. You don't need a prosable for that.
Okay. Yeah. And if you have contractors and they, do you have to tell them explicitly not to work on Shabbat, or is it that you just can't ask them to work on Shabbat?
If a contractor is working within the privacy of their own domain, and it's not obvious to anybody that the work that they're working on is your, item, then they're not like working in your property itself, or doing construction or painting in your property itself, as long as you didn't tell them to work on Shabbos, then it's okay. But if it's in your property itself, then you have to tell them not to work on Shabbos.
Okay. All right, if a truck leaves before Shabbat but arrives at location on Shabbat, can the truck be offloaded by non-Jews? And can the Jew keep the goods?
Well, is it your truck or some other truck? I don't understand.
Sounds like it's the business's either truck or products.
You shouldn't be shipping your products on Shabbos.
Okay. Does Yichud apply to cars?
You're allowed to be alone with a car, but you're not allowed to be alone with a man in a car if it's in a private, abandoned, desolate area. So, and it's late at night, so then it would apply to a car. It's in the middle of the day, so then it doesn't apply to a car.
And if you're driving at night?
You're driving late at night in a way that people, would not be able to see inside or to look inside, and you're in an area where nobody's going to, look inside of the car, so then you should avoid it. Then you should avoid it.
Can you take a taxi or an Uber at night?
If it's on a busy highway, so then you could take it. But if it's going to go into an abandoned street where you don't have lots of cars on the road, so that won't be a problem. If there are a lot of cars on the road, so that then it would be okay. Also, if it's a cab driver, you have another heter. Because it's a heter of uman tovid b'umnase. What does that mean? If somebody is a professional, so then it's assumed that they're not going to get involved in hanky-panky because of the fact that they want to do their job properly. And also, uman lomara b'umnase, if they do something improper, they could lose their license. So that also could be a potential mitigating, factor. But you should, try to avoid these things to the greatest extent that you can.
Okay, are two more questions, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I received an extra $5,000 in my paycheck, which was an error by the accounting debt. Several Jewish people I mentioned this to told me that since I work for a non-Jewish company, I should not have brought this to your attention and returned the money. How is this possible? Wouldn't that be stealing?
So there's a whole discussion about tozakum. A non-Jew, you're not allowed to steal from a non-Jew, obviously, but let's say a non-Jew made a mistake. You're at the cash register, they gave you too much money. You have to point out that they made a mistake. So some say, strictly speaking, it's not required. So the commentator, the Be'er HaGola, is on the side of the Shulchan Aruch. He says that it could be that maybe you don't have a strict obligation. But I'll tell you that I know people who were not careful about this, and they did not inform the non-Jews when too much money was paid, and they lost all of their money, and they lost their shirt. And those who were scrupulous about this and were careful to sanctify Hashem's name and to point out when too much money was given to them, so they were wildly successful in their business enterprises. So he says he thinks that's the better course of conduct. He very strongly urges that you should be honest and look, there's another reason to be honest, which is that it's important for your own midos. It's important for your own character traits. I remember when I was a student in yeshiva, and I was working for a law firm one summer, and they forgot to charge me, they gave me housing in the area, and they forgot to charge me rent. And I called up, and I said, "You forgot to charge me rent." And they said, "What do you mean? We according to our records, you don't owe us anything." I said, "It's ridiculous. I was with you the entire summer. You forgot." They said, "Listen, according to our records, you're fine." I said, "What do you mean I'm fine? I gave you a deposit. You asked for a deposit, and you never asked me for anything else." He said, "Oh, we forgot to return the deposit." So they returned the deposit. It was crazy. So I told what my chavrusa bet at the time. And he said, "Oh, you got this tremendous windfall, so you know you should take me out to dinner or whatever." And then I told my roommate, you know, "What do I do?" I went to one of my rebbeim who said, "Well, they're all non-Jews, so you're not obligated, you know, to fix the error if they're insistent upon the error." So my roommate ended up being a dayan, not here in America. He's a dayan in Yerushalayim now. He ended up learning in Yerushalayim. And he said to me, "It could be that it's 100% mutter, but what about your own midos? What's it going to do to your own character?" So I realized he's 100% right. So I kept on pestering them. So I finally got like the head honcho of, you know, the whole operation there. And I said, "Yeah, I wasn't charged." And then I got like 2 weeks later a very angry letter. "How come you haven't paid us the rent for so many months?" So I took care of it, you know, Baruch Hashem. I think that's the proper course of conduct. That's the way you should be. Yeah.
Okay, and I think this was one of the questions that was from Emma, but is it interest if you charge different prices? Like, if you have an early bird pricing or something, is there an
interest? I didn't touch upon interest. It's a very important point. You have to be very careful that you're not allowed to charge interest from another Jew. And sometimes, even if you sell a product and you say that you're going to have to pay extra because you're paying late, and you have installment payments which end up costing more money than if they would have paid up front, so that's interest. That would be prohibited. So sometimes early bird specials can be interest in the other direction because you're giving them more because of the fact that they paid early. So if that could be an interest problem. Yeah. You have to check it out. Every case is complicated, but yeah, that could be a problem. Yeah. Okay. All right. Everyone should have a ksiva, ksimato, and a good bench year.
Thanks so much.